Good evening. Well, for those who were not here last week, we're going to do a bit of a review. For those of you who were here, let me get this. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay, there we go. Someone gave me that suggestion last week. The purpose of this quarter is to go through evidences of science and archaeology and history to show the biblical support of the Bible. This month, we're going to go through primarily science. We may get into a little bit of literature, but the title of this quarter is Origins, Where We Came From. And this is a quick review of what we talked about last week. If you remember, this question of how did we get here? How did we as a people get here is the most important question any of us needs to come to an answer to. We have to answer that because the answer to that question defines how we see the world around us. If we think that if we come to the conclusion that we are just the results of random chemical reactions and that nobody put us here, then we make life choices based on that decision. If we answer this question that we came here because somebody made us and put us here, then we need to determine who that person is and try and find that entity because that defines our whole life. The message of the Bible is consistent. God said, I made you, I put you here, and I spoke the world into existence. I spoke the world. All the world around you and all the world above you, everything that you can see, I made, and I spoke it into existence in 6 days. So this world around us is, if someone were to ask us, where is the proof of God? Show me this invisible man that you worship in the skies. It was, as I heard it described on the radio one time. The proof of God is the nature around us. If you remember in Acts, Paul said that God did not leave himself without witness, but he did good, giving us the world around us. Romans chapter 1 says that his invisible attributes are clearly seen so that they are without excuse. So if someone says, show me proof about God, hopefully, as we went through last week and this week, we'll have those examples in the world around us to show about God. Because nature is meant to glorify God and act as his witness. And if you remember, we covered some scientific studies that showed that children are just naturally intuitive theists. What does that mean? That children are naturally programmed that when they're shown nature and asked, explain this, their explanation is that somebody created it for a purpose. And regardless of their religious upbringing, whether they were raised in a Christian home or an atheist home, children who are kindergarten, preschool, and early elementary, that's how they explain the world around them. And we see that God designed that. In Romans 2, it talks about the law of the heart, that there are basic concepts of morality that are built into us. And it appears that there's built into us also an understanding that the world was made. It was made by something bigger than us. So that we can see evidence of God's design when nature mimics something that humans have made. And we went through two examples of that. Well, what do you mean by when something is designed? Well, we said that it's easy for us. It's kind of like art. Well, what is art? Well, you know it when you see it. Well, what is design? Well, you know it when you see it. We can see this pile of rocks, and if someone were to ask us, how did those get there? Well, we don't know. Could someone have put them there? Yeah, they could have been put there. Could natural processes have put those rocks there? Yes. We don't know how those got there. But then we see another collection of rocks, and we know, even though they may be the same number and same general size, there's something different. Somebody made this. Well, how do you know? Intuitively, we can see this. We see a sense of symmetry. We see a sense of balance. We can see that there was a thought process that went into this structure and this collection of rocks. So this argument from design is a very natural naturally understood argument. It's the biblical argument for demonstrating God's existence. And we can also demonstrate it by, if we as people made something, we know that we had a thought process, we know that we had a purpose in mind, we made it for that purpose, and then we find out that nature has been doing the same thing. We made something before we found out about nature doing the same thing. If we see a crane and the hydraulics of a crane, we should know somebody made that. You see the hydraulics of a spider leg, the same conclusion. The hydraulics of a crane arm and the hydraulics of a spider leg are the same thing, same fundamental principles, the same conclusion, something made them. So the first thing that we talked about was this little propeller on some bacteria, the flagellum, that looks just like a rotary motor. Then we talked about hydraulic cranes and their arms and how that applies to spider legs and why spiders, when you kill them, their legs shrink up because there's no more blood pressure in the legs. So we're going to talk about a couple of others today. So this is Exhibit 4A. And some of the other things we didn't really talk about, the history of them, like when they were discovered or when they were invented. We're going to talk about this with sonar. Sonar is, hopefully if you're not familiar, it's where you use sound waves in water to locate something. So you have a ship and it creates a sound wave. Maybe it's something that you can hear or something that's outside of our hearing range, and that sound goes through water. Sound moves through water 4.5 times faster than it moves through air. So sound, like water and solids, are really, really good conductors of sound. So you create this sound waves, it rapidly moves through the water, and it hits an object, and then it bounces back. Well, what they found in 1906 with sonar, like they'd known, like since the 1700s, that sound moves through water really well. But in 1906, they realized, hey, if we create a ping, we can listen for that echo. Kind of like if you're at the Grand Canyon or somewhere and you shout and you hear your echo come back at you. If you knew the how fast sound moves through air and you timed that echo, you could get an idea of how far that other object is that your voice bounced off of. Well, they did the same thing with sonar. They said, we can create this ping, then listen for the echo, and we know that there's something that is that far away from us. Well, then what they also found is that if they put a whole bunch of sensors on the front of a sub, or they put a whole bunch of sensors at the bottom of this ship, then they can hear that echo from different locations, and they can create an appearance, what that object looks like. It's not just something there, but it's something that's round, something that is this big. And then they can, based on the echo, they can say that something is stationary, or that something is moving away, or that something is moving towards us. Think about when you're at a railroad stop, and you hear the sound of that train, do you notice that the horn changes pitch? Just do that sometime, or listen. That'll change pitch. As it's coming closer to you, that horn increases in pitch. Well, and it goes away from you, it decreases in pitch. Well, that's how Doppler radars work. Well, this is what this radar sonar does as well. You can determine how far it is, its shape, you can determine its topography and so on. So it was discovered in 1906, used to detect icebergs, generally after, it really became prominent after the Titanic wreck. It was used towards the end of World War I to detect submarines, and it was extensively used in World War II. So we've got this sense that it was discovered in the early 1900s. We weren't the first ones to use sonar. In fact, we were very, very late in the game. It was proposed in 1947, but not confirmed until 1960, that dolphins and all other toothed whales also use sonar when they swim. And this is how this one guy, he was a scientist, and they're trying to capture these dolphins, and they said, well, we can't capture them during the day with the net because they're going to see the net, so we'll capture them at night. What he noticed is that the dolphins, even at night, were able to find the holes in the net. He's like, they can't see. How are they finding these holes? They thought maybe they are using some kind of sonar, because you get underwater around dolphins and you can hear the clicks and the chirps and everything. So then he got a dolphin, then they put suction cups over their eyes. So there's no way the dolphin can see. And then they put the dolphin in a maze, and the dolphin was able to navigate the maze. So they realized the dolphin, those chirps and clicks and stuff, it's not just chatter back and forth, even though part of it is, but it is the eyes of the dolphin seeing its surrounding. The dolphin was using sonar. So this is the structure of a dolphin head. If you look at this thing, I always thought that this was a big lob of fat right there. Okay. Well, that's partly, actually I thought it was the skull. It's not the skull. It's a lob of fat. They call it the melon. Bear with me a little bit here. To me, this is super cool. All right? Their blowhole is right up here. And this is where it creates sound. That sound is directed through this lob of fat. Not just any fat, but that fat acts like a lens. Think if you had a light and you wanted to direct that light to a specific point, you could use a lens and direct that light to different areas. This fat lobe directs that sound like light. It focuses that sound that it creates onto objects. And then, so that sound comes out. Well, where does it listen to the echo? What is its detector? Its lower jawbone is the detector. When that sound hits the jawbone vibrates. Just like when we hear, we're going to show a picture of our ear, we have bones on the inside of our ear, that when sound hits those bones, they vibrate and create an impulse that our body changes from vibrations into sound. So that sound will partly hit the lower jawbone and then go into this little sensor down here at the bottom. But what these dolphins have been able to do is what we do with sonar. They send out this click or a series of clicks, and then they listen for that sound to come back. And the same thing that we can do with sonar, they can do as well. They can look at orientation. They can determine if that something is a fish or if that something is a rock. They can determine how big that is. They can determine if it's moving away or if it's moving towards them. They can find things that are buried underneath the sand. If the prey has buried itself under the sand, they can find that. They're using sonar, and we didn't know about this when we made sonar in the early 1900s. Well, dolphins aren't the only thing to use echolocation. What's the other thing that uses echolocation? Bats. Now, if you don't like bats, just don't look at the screen right now. All right. Bats do the same thing, but instead of doing it in water, they do it in air. Now, here's the story of... So, again, remember, sonar and radar were both discovered about the same time, both a form of echolocation. In the late 1700s, there was a scientist who wanted to see how bats fly. So he got a dark room, and he put strings all over this room. And in the dark, he wanted to see how often a bat ran into one of these strings. They never ran into any of the strings. Well, he thought he was like, this is really weird. Well, then about 50 years later, another scientist got these bats and he stuffed their ears full of wax. The bats didn't do so well in the string room this time. They kept on hitting the strings. So they had some kind of connection with their ability to fly through the night and miss objects and their ears. Well, at the time, they thought that maybe, you know, they couldn't hear the bats making any sound, so they thought it was like cat whiskers, that there's something that they were touching that allowed them to, it was a sense of touch that they were able to avoid all of these things. Well, in 1938, when we were able to detect ultrasonic sound, which is sound outside of our hearing range, they realized that bats are making a sound, And they're doing the same things that dolphins do. So again, it's the same thing, this Doppler shift and sound waves. They're flying through the air. The object that they're chasing is flying through the air. So they're able to figure out, okay, is that a leaf or is that a bug? Okay, that's a bug. And that bug is this big and that bug is flying in this direction. All by these series of sounds that they issue. Now, we know where they hear it. They hear it from their ears. Well, the sound doesn't always come through their mouth. Most of the time, it'll come through the mouth. But if you look at the nose of some bats, their nostrils are huge. Well, it's because the sound is coming through the nostrils. Their mouth is not the megaphone. It's their nose that's the megaphone. Now, here's the other conundrum, is that if they were able to hear their own screech, they would go deaf. So that lasts like once, and then they don't have echolocation. So their ears have a special adaptive feature. I was talking with Natalie about this on the way home, and remember when you would create tin can telephones? All right, you take that string between the two cans and you'd stretch them out, and you could talk between each other. Well, what would happen if your brother came by and did this to the tin can telephone? Just cut that line. Yeah, now you don't have a tin can telephone anymore. The connection is broke. The reason why we can hear in that tin can telephone is our sound, our voice, going through this can creates a vibration that goes all the way through the string into the other tin can. And when that string vibrates in the other can, it creates a voice. So that's how we can hear it. So if you break, whoops, don't do that. Okay, if you break the connection, then the vibrations can't continue on. Same thing happens when a bat screams. These are the three bones of our inner ear. Bats have the same thing. This is our eardrum. And when sound hits that, it causes all three of these bones to vibrate. Well, the bats have a special muscle right there on the stirrup or the foot plate, the stirrup, that when they scream, that muscle breaks that connection. So those bones are no longer connected. So what does that mean? The bats are deaf at the same moment that they're issuing that scream. And then that muscle relaxes just in time for them to hear their echo. Sonar, we thought we were really cool in making this. Dolphins and bats do the same thing. They do it better than us. They do it far better than us. If someone were to see a sonar machine and how it's made, they would come to the conclusion somebody made this. It is the same logical conclusion when you study dolphins and bats. Somebody made that. And even before we knew about bats and dolphins in the first century, this is what a Greek historian said. Can it be that those things which are most important and most essential for happiness do not call for intelligence nor have any part in the processes of reason and forethought? Nobody wets clay with water and leaves it, assuming that by chance or accidentally there will be bricks. Nor after providing himself with wool and leather does he sit down with a prayer to chance that they turn into a cloak and shoes for him. Even back then, looking at simple things as bricks and clothes, he said, there's no way that the things that are most important to us are the objects of chance. So what we're going to take a brief aside, and I think it's important for us to understand the other side. Those of our friends who don't believe in creation, who believe in evolution, to understand a little bit about this theory so that way we can ourselves judge how the processes of that theory compare to the things around of the world that we see them. Now remember, you don't have to be a scientist to make these kinds of judgments. Remember, I talked last week that we all have common science about us. That's why we can recognize design. That's why we can do certain things in the world. So we'll spend you'll just bear with me a little bit. We'll spend a little bit of time talking about evolution. That way you have some baseline knowledge about it without getting too much into the details. In 1859, Charles Darwin, in English, published this book called Of the Origin of Species. Charles Darwin had been raised in a Bible-believing home. He began having his doubts about that, and he had struggles, if you read his memoirs. He had some struggles with it. But he went over to the Galapagos Islands, and we'll study about those what he saw in the Galapagos Islands that led him to this. But he wrote this book on the origin of species that was followed up in 1871 by a book called Of the Descent of Man. And in these books, he describes what he felt was a natural explanation of how we got here. Not by an almighty creator, but by natural processes of one thing changing into another thing, changing into another thing over time. The technical term today is called Neo-Darwinism, and it has its roots in these two books. Neo-Darwinism just means applying the world of genetics to Darwin's original theory. When he wrote his book, the natural extension of that is everything around us today, all living organisms, whether it's a little bug, to a person, to an elephant, to a bacteria, all of those things have to have a common ancestor. Not just all people having a common ancestor, but every living thing eventually started at the same place and branched itself out. Like a spider web, all the veins of a spider web will come to the same point. He believed if you could trace all animals back in their history, they would all come back to the same single ancestor. And it began with some birds. He went to the Galapagos Islands, which is off of the coast of South America, and he noticed all of these finches. They're called Darwin's finches today. And he noticed that they had different sizes of beaks. And he said, if you could arrange these in a circle or arrange them in a line, you could see this gradual progression of beak size. And he noticed that depending on the food that they were eating, that determined how big their beak was. So he wondered, well, if the food source changes and a bird has the improper size beak, he theorized that meant that over time that bird would change its beak size. So instead of eating insects, now it would be able to crack seeds. So this was the genesis of his theory of evolution. So he calls it adaptation. Adaptation just is modification, descent with modification. That one generation passes on slight genetic changes to another generation that passes those on. If that change is advantageous, meaning it allows that organism to live longer or to reproduce better, then that change will be fixed and passed on to the next generation. So the two central principles are descent with modification and survival of the fittest. So when you hear natural selection is just survival of the fittest. The ones who are stronger, who have a physical advantage, are the ones who are going to survive. If you took biology in high school or in middle school, you probably had one or both of these examples that are up there. The first one is called the spotted moth. This is a moth that was in England. And before the Industrial Revolution, the majority of these moths were white. The reason why they were white is because when they landed on the bark of a tree, they were hidden. Now, there were black moths, that were these black spotted moths, but when they landed on the trees, they didn't survive very long because birds could come and see them and kill them. So there were predominantly more white ones than there were black ones. Well, then the Industrial Revolution came around, and all of this coal smoke turned the bark of the trees black. And what they noticed is that the white moths were now declining and the black moths were increasing. So therefore, you had survival of the fittest because the black moths could hide under this dust-covered tree. Then they had an advantage. Well, then when coal stopped being used, then the trees became white again and the white moths came back. So here's a question. Is any new information being created in these moths? No. You're either born a white moth or you're born a black moth. If you're born a black moth, depending if it's a black tree or not, you might live or die. There's no information. No new information. The other example that's given is giraffe neck length. Giraffes eat trees, and the idea was that giraffes have long necks because the trees started getting taller and taller. And if you were if you had a stump of a neck of a giraffe, you couldn't reach the leaves, so therefore you wouldn't survive. But if you had a longer neck than those around you, then you could eat more leaves than them, so you would survive. So therefore, giraffes got longer and longer necks. So those are the classical examples that evolutionists have portrayed, at least in the grade school level or middle school level. So just some important points to take away from this. All organisms are simply links in a chain of creatures that are constantly morphing from one into another. If you talk with evolutionists, they believe that we as our bodies today are just another link. And there are further links down that line unless we become extinct. That if we were to see humanity 1,000, 10,000 years from now, they would not look like us. The changes have to be gradual because they're small changes, bit by bit. And only those features that are passed on to offspring factor into evolution. Well, what do you mean by that? Let's say I become we lived in the 1700s and I became a blacksmith. All right. I'd have some guns for muscles in my arms. All right. Swinging that hammer, get these huge muscles. Does that mean if I have a son, he's going to have huge muscles? No. That's a change that I develop because of my environment, not that I change, that I pass on genetically. So only those changes that are able to be passed on to your children are going to be those that determine the course of evolution. And the process is completely unguided. It's random and unguided. Remember we talked about William Paley and his story about a watch. And he said, you see a watch, you have to know that there's a watchmaker. You see a human, you have to know that there is a human maker. There's a creator. Well, in the 1980s, there was a book written called The Blind Watchmaker. And it was by an evolutionist who said, there is no all-seeing watchmaker. Evolution is the blind watchmaker. No care, no concern about the result of its changes. It just happens. But when you read evolutionary theory, they personify all of the changes, like giving it meaning. So they're stuck in this quandary. There is, in evolutionary theory, strictly taught, there is no room for God. Modern science follows the path of Darwin because Darwinism is naturalistic explanations of the world around us. They want to find explanations that are based on natural processes that you can see today, that you can observe today, that you can test today, that you can repeat today. It has to be a natural process. That's what modern scientists seek to do in explaining all of the world around them. Darwinism applies a supposed natural explanation for the world. Only laws or only explanations that deal with actual natural laws and processes of science are allowed. If you bring in God, that is a supernatural explanation, and therefore it's not allowed. Because their response is, how are we to test this? How are we to prove it? How are we to see this God? We can't. That is not science. They take the idea and the concept of God and push it aside as supernatural, as mythic, as something that doesn't belong in academic studies of science, whether chemistry, biology, physics, geology, or astronomy. And God is not even allowed into the discussion. Some of you may remember late 1990s, early 2000s. Well, Kansas wanted to, the State Board of Education wanted, they passed a ruling that would allow schools to teach intelligent design as a viable scientific explanation for where we came from. Well, the whole, there was chaos, utter chaos, because people thought, well, all you're trying to do is get the Bible into the science room, into the classroom. There's nothing wrong with that. It'd probably help us out a lot. But intelligent design, if you remember, is not trying to answer the who is the designer question. Intelligent design is to demonstrate that the most logical scientific explanation is a designer. Identifying that designer is outside of science and falls into the realm of religion, realm of scripture. But for scientists, they don't even want to consider, most scientists don't even want to consider God as an explanation. Every other possibility is legit. Remember I talked about the co-discoverer of DNA? One of them even proposed this theory that's called transpermeation, meaning that he couldn't come up with a reasonable, logical explanation of how life got here. So his explanation is that aliens planted the seed of life on Earth and then left. Because he felt it had to start somewhere. Well, maybe aliens put it here. That was, and it was considered scientifically credible. But if you say, no, that entity is God, well, no, we can't talk about that. God, no intelligence is allowed. God is not allowed. So we should probably ask ourselves, why is this so popular? Why is evolution, this concept, so popular within scientists, and why do even a lot of our secular friends believe or hold into evolution? Well, one is that it frees the conscience. Remember that question of how we got here? If the answer is we're just the result of natural processes, then you can do whatever you want to do. You can live whatever life you want. You can be a good person if that makes you feel good. You can be a bad person if that makes you feel good. When you're dead, you're dead. There are no consequences. There is no God that you're going to have to answer to. You can see how this frees up the conscience. The other is, you may talk with some of your friends who aren't scientists, and we just accept information that's given to us by authority figures without challenging it. And we hear someone who we perceive to be an authority figure, whatever realm that be, but here in the realm of science, they sound convincing, their credentials look convincing, we don't think that we can argue with them, so we just accept it. They have to know what they're talking about. All believe that. Well, that's a bad approach biblically, and that's a bad approach when it comes to science. Work out your own salvation. If I give a lesson, don't trust me, trust God. All right, so the scientist tells you something, use your common science. Does it make sense? Remember that false teaching can be presented in a very persuasive manner if you have no love for the truth. 2 Thessalonians 2:9-12, the coming of the lawless one is by the activity of Satan with all power and false signs and wonders and with all wicked deception for those who are perishing because they refuse to love the truth and so be saved. Therefore, God sends them a strong delusion so that they may believe what is false. I believe that there are a multitude of false teachings out there that are incredibly persuasive. Evolution being one of those. If you have no love for the truth, then you have no barrier to protect yourself from their sway. If we don't want to believe in God, then we'll believe in whatever we want to, and God will allow us to believe in whatever we want to, knowing what that will do to our souls. All right, remember, let's go back to children. We previously discussed that children were those intuitive theists when it comes to nature and creation. Remember this verse in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. God has chosen what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. Our children can teach us so many lessons. They can teach us how we can be better. Often they're mirrors and parrots that we wish they would not do what we did or say what we say, because we don't like that. But they are also pure, untainted minds. And out of the mouth of babes, here we can learn a lot from our children about the wonders of life around us. Perhaps we need to remember what it's like to chase butterflies and fireflies and be thrilled about God's creation. All right. So if our only examination of the world around us, as Darwin did, was what we could see with the unaided eye, it could make sense. You could line up these fossils or line up these things in what appears to be an orderly arrangement and say, it looks like there is a progression. It's very convincing to line this up with this up with this and this and say, see, it all lines up. If you're just looking visually at something, that could make sense. But remember, even though that is contrary to our own intuition, that's how people have viewed the world for millennia. They just, with what their unaided eye can see. But when we start looking at the world closer, whole new worlds open up to us. And then this theory of Darwinism becomes far more challenging. As you look closer, you realize there's a whole lot more than what I first thought. And you look closer and you start peeling all of these layers off. The complexity builds upon the complexity, and then it becomes much more difficult to see this as a random act. Darwin could only go so far. He didn't know what he didn't know. He didn't have the scientific testing that we have now, so he didn't know all of the challenges the genetics would prove to his theory. So this is what happens when we look closer. You look at the night sky, and you see these stars. I encourage you to do that. One of the first careers that I wanted to get into was something about space, because it's just incredible to go outside away from all the light pollution and see the stars. We get an idea of what the stars look like, but we know there's more than what we can see with our eyes. So we create telescopes, and then we create telescopes that we put up in space, the Hubble telescope, so that way the atmosphere isn't distorting it. And the Hubble telescope did something profound. This here is an image of the Hubble telescope, and you see this looks like bunches of stars. When you zoom in on it, it's not stars. It's more galaxies. So the closer you get, this image here, I saw this in a National Geographic one time, and it just fascinated me. That space just keeps on going. And the closer you look, the more complex the space is. You think they're stars? No, they're not. They're galaxies, which are groups of even more stars. So the closer you look, the more complex things are. So use your intuition. We're going to talk about the body. Use your intuition as we look closer about the body. Does it make intuitive sense that these are the result of random, unguided processes? Does it pass the smell test? Okay? If it doesn't smell right, it probably isn't. So use the smell test on these things. Do these features, though, leave us without excuse that there is a creator? All right, so you're going to have to bear with me. Fortunately, you only have like 5 more minutes of this before we break. But tonight, and then Lord willing, next Wednesday, we're really going to get into some details about science. It was going to get technical, but the whole purpose of that is to convince you that this image doesn't even compare to what our bodies are the closer that you look at them. All right, and remember, science is fun, okay? At least I think it's fun. And I hope that you think it's fun. When David saw the human body, he saw the beauty of God in it. Psalm 139, 13 through 14. For you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, my soul knows well. David saw this. David couldn't even see a fraction of what we can see today about the human body. We know more about the body today. We should be even more convinced that we have been fearfully and wonderfully made by God. So let's look at a typical human body. Thing one is the example. And just so you know, here's thing two. I don't know if we get to... All right. Careful the pictures you give us for our 50th anniversary, all right? We have within our body 78 different organs. Our organs are what makes our body do the things that they do. Our heart, our lungs, our stomach, our kidneys are all organs. Then there's all kinds more than that. There are about 11 major systems when you group those. The circulatory system, digestive, nervous, groups of organs working together for a similar function. The skeletal system typically has about 206 bones. Some of you may have more than that. You may have bones that I don't have. Some of you may have less than that, bones that you were born with that had to be taken away. The muscular system has about 640 named muscles. It is estimated that we have 37 trillion different cells within our body. The current life expectancy of a person is right now 79 years. Within those 79 years, your heart will beat 3.3 billion times. What is that? Your heart is a muscle. It never stops beating, which is good. We want it that way, all right? For 79 years, it non-stops beating. And then when we get excited, it goes even faster. When we get scared, it goes even faster. It will beat 3.3 billion times. And during that time, you will take over 600 million breaths in your life if you live to be the age of 79. Those are important things that we don't even think about, but yet our body does. And for our last slide, here are some other amazing facts about our body. Your brain requires electricity in order to function. The amount of electricity is 20 watts of power. A typical light bulb in your kitchen may be 40 or 60 watts, so it's going to be like a dim light bulb. We think, well, that's not a lot. Well, a typical laptop computer can run on about 20 watts of power. However, if we are trying to create computers to do what your brain can do, one laptop can't do it. It took 82,000 processors in a supercomputer to mimic what the brain can do in 1 second. Your brains are really, really, really good computers. You can think about all of the sights and sounds and things that you can do, and you can store memory. All of this stuff compacting this little melon inside of our head. Bone is 5 times stronger than a steel bar of the same width. The body cools itself through the evaporation of sweat to avoid overheating. You know, we think of boiling water as a heating process. Boiling is actually a cooling process. So when we sweat, that evaporation is cooling our bodies, taking heat away from our bodies and turning it into water vapor. An infant, for its first 9 months, is surrounded by water, but immediately coming out of the womb knows how to breathe and is capable of breathing air on its own. And bone and an infant's head are not connected. You think if, you know, a child that is born naturally, they got that nice little cone head to them. Well, why is that? My bones and my head are all stuck together. They're all fused together. When a baby is born, these bones up here are not fused together, which is really good. If they were fused together, the child would not get born. The child would not make it out of the birth canal, and the child and the mother would both die. But because these bones are not connected, they can overlap. They can slide. So as that head is coming out of the birth canal, God designed our heads as infants so that those bones slide over each other, allow the head to get a little smaller for us to pass through the birth canal, and then we stretch back out over a couple of days so we're not cone heads anymore. But that's good for children being born. That's really bad for, like me when I was a kid, when I bumped my head all the time. So over the next months or year, those bones fuse together, creating this nice little skull that we have that protects our brain. So this is the human body. And next week, Lord willing, we are going to get into even more detail about, we're going to start with one system and keep going on and going on and going on. Hopefully, you aren't scared away. You'll come back and enjoy it. But that's the goal for next Wednesday. I hope I have convinced you, if you needed convincing, to at least consider, if you haven't already accepted the possibility or likelihood, that you were made. You were made with a purpose. You were made with something in mind. An almighty creator who had a plan, who had an idea, made you and gives you good gifts. At the end of every day of creation, God said, "It is good," and you are good. But he knew you would fail. He knew I would fail and make mistakes. He knew that for me, my mistakes were incurable on my own. I violated his laws, and the penalty of that is death. And God decided, even before he made any of us, that he was going to help us. The only way to pay the price of death is for someone else to take that death for us. I can't die for you, and you can't die for me to pay the penalty of that sin. Only someone greater than you and I can pay for that sin. God had to do it. So God sent his son. For those of you who are parents, I know you would die for your children. Would you send your children to die for someone? Would you send your child to die for someone who didn't like you, who rebelled against you, who provoked you to anger? The Lord did that because he was able to see beyond all of that, that there was hope on the other side of the cross, that there is hope on the other side of sin, that we still have the potential to be righteous sons and daughters for him. And we have the potential to stand before him and lift up holy hands to praise him. But it takes coming to the cross, accepting the death of the Savior, and following him into the grave for that to become a reality. If that is your wish tonight and you wish to take those steps, please come forward as we stand and sing the song that's selected.